Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
Morning, everyone, from cloudy, rainy, and cold Westchester County. But we're going to have a fantastic show. We're going to talk to the author of, one of the authors of Birthright, Lou Aragnica, and the other author is Julian Origori, and Birthright will keep you spellbound from start to finish as one mother created a life for her son, an astonishing truth come out that will change many lives, and you will be shocked. This book is fantastic, and we have the author of the book, Lou Aragnica, here, and good morning. How you doing? This is exciting. I'm so glad we finally got here.
A pleasure to be here, friend. Thanks for having me.
Well, this book is really interesting. So when you created this novel, it sounded like it was written in two distinct voices, Alex at the beginning and then Sandra in the past. How did you create, I read 1,000 books. How did you create flashbooks that told the story in the past and the present and keep the reader knowing exactly who's speaking?
Well, I think, yes, one of the author's most important jobs is to create characters that are so distinctive that the reader has no problem following along who is where and where they are. I actually spend a tremendous amount of time before I even start writing any work of fiction developing my characters. So I could go 6 months before I start, I put a single word on the page, just developing the characters, getting to know the characters, getting to know all kinds of things about the characters that will never show up in the book itself, just so that when I'm writing that character, I'm fully in that character's voice. And to me, if you do that effectively, then the reader, the reader has the same experience on the other end, and they would never confuse one character for another because the characters are distinctly themselves.
That requires a big talent because, like I said, I read hundreds of thousands of books, and sometimes I'm going like, which one is it this time? And when they have like four or five voices, and they know like this is Tom's voice, this is Mary's voice, this is this one, and sometimes I'm saying, well, wait a minute, the title says this, and it's really not that. I can lose your mind. So how did you come up with the two storylines? And tell us about Alex and Allie. I like her. She's so cute. She's so good.
Some of this is actually is inspired by some real events. Not all of it, but some of it, so that was a starting point. But essentially what we wanted to do was tell a story about a family that has had some extraordinary things happen to it, but that is very rooted in the real world, and with Alex, Alex's story is that he is an enormously successful businessman, but has a complicated personal past, and he's connected to some forces outside of the natural world. He has the ability to see things that other people can't see, not in some weird, superhero way, but in a way that's actually, there's a fair amount of real history behind, people being able to see things like auras and that sort of thing. And he uses that ability to enhance his profession. But he also has a connection to a family history that is dotted with these extraordinary moments and some moments that are more problematic and his relation and one of his core relationships is with a guy that he met back when he was in his 20s who is actually the crown prince of a country that we created a European country that we created that's a lot like Spain, but not exactly Spain. And that relationship sort of drives a lot it drives and informs a lot of what happens in his life, because their friendship is filled with drama and with moments that change both of them in substantial ways.
Yeah, I know, and I like that character too. So tell us about his connection to Leon and the royal family. Like you said, he was close to the king and he was close to Fernando. I like Fernando.
Yeah, Fernando is his best friend and the crown prince who is a reluctant crown prince. He actually has no desire to become king.
I know.
But he's sort of forced upon this. He's a playboy. He's a womanizer. He likes to live an outsized life and has really no desire to focus on more serious things, with one significant exception, which is that he actually is fascinated with the world of education and believes that he can really help children and help schools and that sort of thing. But the problem is that, as it is true in most kingdoms, the monarchy actually has very little power. It's more ceremonial, and the area of education is not something that he is allowed to participate in anything more than a ceremonial way. And so he finds this very frustrating, and just further evidence that he should just party his life away. And that's how Alex meets him. And they have a lot of fun together, but Alex takes life way more seriously, and that creates some complications in not only their relationship but in Fernando's life.
Well, the reason why I love him is because I'm an educator and a reading specialist. Yeah, and I did. Yeah, I am, and I'm really good at this stuff too. and I still help kids with their reading, and some teachers actually use me as a consultant. So when he said he wanted to help children to read better and to learn better, I go, yeah, you go to it, definitely, because we could use that.
Yeah,
we could use that in the real world today, because the education system is really not so great.
That's one of the great frustrations in his life, because he feels like he has something substantial to contribute there, and he's not being given any opportunity to do so.
Well, I think they should fund him. So why did Fernando, he thought he was just an ornament, whatever. So why did the king, what did they always call Alex? He was needed. Leon is so often the problems that they're facing. How come they used Alex all the time? And then we're going to talk about somebody I didn't like.
Well, the reigning monarch of Leon, who Alex refers to as four, because he's the fourth in this monarchal line, is somebody who he basically considers Alex to be the son he never had, because Alex is very grounded. He is enormously successful. He takes everything seriously, and he has a very keen business mind. And the country, has gone through a number of challenges. With the economy, with certain things that Alex has real expertise in, and so the king turns to Alex for help because he can't get any help from his own son, and this is a source it's a source of some frustration for Fernando, but at the same time, it's just sort of confirmation that Fernando really is just as you said, an ornament. And
yeah,
and he kind of goes with it. He kind of accepts it because, like I said, he doesn't want to be king. He doesn't want to have any official function. And you know, he loves Alex as his best friend. And so you know, if Alex and his father get along, great.
Yeah, I know. So tell us about, I don't like this guy. The prime minister always tries to undercut the king, and he doesn't like him. He wants to turn the country, we got to watch out for people like this, into a dictatorship. So what was his plan? And, oh, gosh, what can I say?
Well, I mean, his name is Romeo Olgar, and Olgar is... Olgar is sort of representative of the populist movement that's taken hold in a large part of the world. We're somewhat familiar with it here, and his agenda is the history of León is that it's been a democracy for a long time, but like Spain under Franco, there was a period of dictatorship where. Where freedoms were curtailed and where people were living in much in constrained condition, and that was largely because of economic problems. It was allowed to happen because of economic problems and that sort of thing. And the country is again facing some economic issues, and that allows Olgar to enact some. Well, to come into power in the first place, and then to enact some restrictions that begin to affect the way people can live in the country, and it becomes clear that his plan is not to limit himself to León, but to that he has much larger aims, and that is one of the driving plot elements in this story because. The king brings Alex in to try to help come up with some way to keep Olgar in check. And in the process, many things are revealed, much is discovered, and it gets way crazier than anybody anticipated.
Now this was
and we learned some
part.
Things about Olgar that, I'm sorry?
Yeah, this was the interesting part. Well, he meets with him. So he devises a plan to take him down, but his daughter and the great-grandmother, well, she's not there anymore, but how does the significance of the aura and his daughter and great-grandmother help him, and how does he connect with her? I wish I could do that. No, really, I really wish I could.
Well, there's a history in Alex's family of being able to see things on a sort of other plane. And his great grandmother was actually a legendary seer in their home in South America, and she and Alex connect across the ether at some point prior to the start of this novel, and have developed a relationship where they can connect with each other. At times of need. Alex's daughter, Allie, has an ability that nobody has seen before, which is that she not only can read auras when she's in front of somebody, which, there's a fair amount of evidence that there are people who can do this, but she can actually also read them online. She can look at a video of somebody and read their aura from that, and that's something that nobody has shown an ability to do before. So Allie's talent actually becomes central to the story, even though she's 10 years old, and the last thing that Alex wants to do is involve his daughter in any situation that could be as dangerous as dealing with a ruthless dictator, and that. Comes around to a key moment in the story that I'm not going to share with you because I can share with you because you've read it, but I don't want to share with listeners because I'd like them to discover that themselves.
Well, if they don't read this, I don't know what's wrong with them, really, seriously. I mean, really, seriously speaking. I mean, like I said, I don't read just everything. But this was really interesting, and I had no idea what I was reading, and I said, oh, my God, this is really different. So let's go to the other voice in the book, Sandra.
Mm-hmm.
Do I like her? Yeah, I do like her. Tell us about Sandra and her time with Caetano. And how did they hide their time together? This was so cool. I mean, at that time and whatever, and she was not paying attention to somebody else. But that's okay. How did they meet? That was so clever. Like, oh, my God. She's supposed to be so prim and proper. I love her. She's great. My kind of person.
Well, yeah, Sandra is a woman who comes of age in the 60s. She's, you know, in many ways ahead of her time because she, you know, she's pursuing a career in finance at a time when women were thought to not be, have the capacity to do things like that. And she has, you know, significant ambitions that are being tamped down by her uncle. Her father died, and her uncle is her caretaker, and he's tamping them down because he wants her to, you know, to assume her proper place in society and to find a husband and to just, you know, be a good wife. Her uncle sends her on a trip to Europe just as a sort of graduation gift. And while she's there, she meets this fascinating guy who she connects with instantly. And they have a very electric period of 2 days where they're together that ends, you know, with their having to go back to their own responsibilities. He's got to go back to the family business. She's got to go back to South America and try to start a career. But those 2 days were fairly unforgettable. And what happens when she gets back is that within a short time, her uncle arranges for her to marry somebody who is a perfectly nice guy, but he's kind of there's kind of nothing much to him. But he comes from a noble family, and so her uncle likes the idea of being connected to this nobility. So he drives her to. He doesn't convince her. He just tells her that's what's going to happen. And she, believing that she's had her one great romantic moment, goes along with it because she doesn't see any other way to get around it. But she's being fitted for her. For her wedding gown in Milan, because her uncle has lots of money and lots of connections, so he sends her to Milan to have her wedding gown done. And Caetano, the guy she met the year before, tracks her down there, and they have yet another electric period of 2 days together, and this leads to a connection that persists throughout the rest of their lives, that they find a way every year to get together, even though she gets married, she has a family, he gets married, he has a family, they have huge responsibilities, she has a huge she does become a very successful businesswoman, he's got his family business to take care of. But they continue to see each other, and we see them over 5 year periods. We see them at once every 5 years as their lives evolve. And there are various times during that relationship where moments occur where they could be together, in a more permanent way, but the opportunity is not right for one or the other. And that's sort of the story of this relationship, is that, you know, that they have these wonderful golden moments once a year, but that's really how they're meant to live their lives together.
What would happen? My grandfather tried to do this to me too when I was younger. he had the rabbi son. And it wasn't that I didn't like the rabbi's son. I just wasn't quite religious for them, which was perfectly okay.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, what would happen if she said, no, I'm not going to marry him? What would he have done to uncle?
Well,
no, seriously, what would happen? Like, I'm not doing this. I'm moving, and that's it. No, uh-uh.
Well, I think she would have, I think she would have been, you know, he probably would have cut her off.
Wow.
You know, at the time, that would have been problematic because there was certainly no guarantee that she was going to be able to. Even at this point, you know, she's working at a company, and every opportunity is going to the men in the company, and she's left with you know picking up the scraps. So there was no guarantee that she was going to be able to make a living for herself, and she. You know, and she was nervous about that. Remember, it was the 60s. It was a very different time for women. And so she, she sort of buys into it. And I think her feeling was, to some degree, she becomes resigned to it, I did that to mirror Fernando's resignation of his fate, where he's sort of accepting that, you know, he's stuck being this, you know, reluctant crown prince, and you know that life is just like what life is. Both of them come to realize there's more to it than that. But that's the situation that they find themselves in.
That's so sad. But this was interesting because it goes to different time periods from the 1998 and then goes back to the 60s. So did you have to do any research into the period of the 60s?
Sure. Yeah. Quite a bit to make sure that they sort of got all of the the settings right. You know, it's easy to slip up in that area because you're accustomed to to living in this world and to to seeing to modern conveniences and modern methods of communication. And that sort of thing, and modern political circumstances even, and certainly modern social circumstances. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in writing about that couple in the 60s, both of them had to deal with very, very different conventions. So the world that, you know, they're a product of the world that they grew up in.
So I have this got me worried. Seriously. And I knew why you did it, but not really. I didn't want to know. I'm not going to tell. Why did Fernando disappear? And Alex is called to find him. But it affects his position in his company, and they're not happy with him either. So how does he deal with that? But yet he knew that he had to do the king the favor to find Fernando. And I won't tell you what he was doing.
Fernando, at some point, Fernando just can't handle his role as crown prince anymore. And what it really comes down to, and again, this is the mirror of Sandra's story. What it comes down to is that the king is now proposing marriage partners for him, and he proposes a woman who, under almost any other circumstance, would be a great partner, but not if somebody else is suggesting it. And Fernando finally just says, I can't take this anymore. He disappears. And the king has all of his people looking for his son, but they're not finding him. And so he goes to Alex to try to find him because he thinks that Alex knows things about Fernando that nobody else does, and that he might have access that nobody else would have. And so Alex chooses to do so because, Fernando is his best friend. He loves the king. He wants to be able to do these things, although he's putting his own career at risk by doing so, because at some point he needs to track down a lead, and doing so requires him to miss out on some key meetings leading up to an important presentation. But he does it because at the end of the day, this relationship is more important to him than even his own career. And that leads to some dramatic moments that, again, I'll let the readers discover for themselves.
Yeah. Well, how does this – well, he's got a great personality, and I think more people could use somebody like him because especially with what's going on in the news and everything, he seems to be able to diffuse – that's why they call me all the time – difficult situations. And he's able to handle things that most people can't. I mean, he could be an arbitrator, seriously, or a mediator or something. But also, how does this affect his family? Because he's constantly on the move doing something.
Well, I mean, it's certainly, you know, I mean, when he's tracking down Fernando at in that timeline, he doesn't have a family. He's by himself. But later when the king calls him in to try to help deal with the despotic prime minister, he takes a substantial amount of time in León to help out in this situation. And at that point, he does have a wife and daughter, and there's a large stretch of time where he needs to be away from them. One of the key moments in the book, however, comes when the king says to him, "Yeah, why don't you bring them over? You know, let's have them come for some time as well." His wife is a freelance writer, so you know she has a certain amount of flexibility in her work. His daughter is going to school, but he decides, you know, okay, 10 days in León is probably a greater education than she's going to get during those 10 days in school. So okay, I'll bring them over, and that trip, having them come over, is actually central to a key element that happens in the last act of the novel.
Well, she loves it there, Allie. Why does she love it? She doesn't want to leave. I mean, she loves the king, and she just loves the country. And most kids would say, "Oh, why am I here? What am I doing here? I could be with my friends. I could do my whatever." But why was she so drawn to this place? She didn't want to leave.
She feels totally connected to it from the second she sees it. One of the things about León is that it is naturally beautiful. It's a gorgeous. It has a gorgeous landscape, and she just connects with that instantly, falls in love with it. Kind of likes the idea of hanging around a palace. You know, it's not something she's accustomed to. She's accustomed to living in a Manhattan high rise, and. You know, all of the trappings, you know, this gorgeous country, this beautiful palace, all of these people who are waiting on you and catering to your every whim. It's kind of cool to be 10 years old and having access to all that stuff. And so she really gets it. But at the same time, she becomes a key player in resolving the situation, so she's paying her way.
What else can you tell us about, without giving anything away, about Sandra in the present? I like Sandra.
Well, yeah, what I can tell you about Sandra is that she does become enormously successful. Ultimately, sells her business so she can move to America with her children, and she ultimately does give up on the relatively loveless marriage that she'd been living with for a long time. However, that doesn't change things for her and Cayetano in the way that he would like them to change, because she has to sort of be the rational one of the two and realize that that it would be too difficult for him to leave his wife to face the fallout of doing something like that, and so she allows her cooler head to prevail in this situation. But she goes on and has a great you know, a great life with her her children and her grandchildren, and she's you know, and she's very content with who she's wound up becoming. But her story dovetails with Alex's story in a very dramatic way toward the end. But once again, I'm not going to share with that.
Oh, I'm not either, but just get your tissues out, people. No, seriously. I was like, I wasn't sure, and I go like, oh, this is really good. So how did
that's
you,
a big
I mean.
Challenge. You know, that's a big writing challenge.
Yeah, that was a big challenge,
know.
Let me tell you.
Well, there are a lot of secrets in this novel, and I think, you know, for people who are listening to this conversation, they're saying, you know, we've got this story.
They are listening. You got a switchboard lit up here, people.
These stories all come together. They all come together in a way that will, I believe, feel completely logical at the end, but aren't revealed until late in the last act. And that's a tremendous writing challenge. And the only way that I know how to address that is to plan it all out very carefully ahead of time. And then to put little seeds in the story all along the way so that it doesn't seem like a crazy surprise when it happens, but at the same time, people don't guess it way before it happens. And it is one of the most challenging things that I've dealt with as a writer. I think, you know, writing characters to me is very natural. Doing this is not. it's definitely.
What do you mean, a radio show?
No. Doing a radio show is fine. I meant writing, keeping a big secret from the reader until the very end.
That's even
and
harder,
not screwing up. That's a very challenging thing, and it took a lot of careful effort to make sure that I got it right, because, you know, one of the problems.
Mm-hmm.
For both me and Julian, is we knew what the story was, you know. So so it's you never really know if you've done a good job, because you always know how the story is going to turn out. So ultimately, you know, you just do the best work you can in terms of revealing enough, but also keeping enough back. And then hope the reader, feels it at the end.
Well, see, you know, you did a good job if I give it 5 stars, which I did.
Yes, you did. I appreciate that.
I know, that's right. That's how you know you did a good job. And then Cheryl said, you're going to interview him. You don't have a choice. No, she just sent. At times people just send things and I never know they're coming. And I go like, what? But this I knew it was coming. So you connected the two stories. But when you created these stories or the characters, did you do the storylines together, or did you just do them one storyline and then the other? How do you co-author something like that and let it come out to be such a great book?
It's all about, it's funny because there are two kinds of writers in the world. There are planners and there are pantsers. Pantsers meaning they write from the seat of their pants. I'm definitely a pantser. I'm definitely a planner. I will spend, months really, storyboarding until I feel the story is where it needs to be before I start writing. And so in this case, I knew I had three significant storylines that I need to follow. I needed to tell Sandra's story. I needed to tell Alex's story in his early days with Fernando, and then I needed to tell Alex's story. Mm-hmm. In the present day with what was happening in Leon, and I needed to weave all those stories together. I actually do it in an Excel spreadsheet. I'm not sure how other writers do it, but all of those stories were developed contemporaneously, but then I also sort of pulled each one of those stories out to make sure that the individual arc was there. So if you only read those, the 1998 story, that it would be a complete story, that it wasn't just a fragment of a story. And the same thing was true with the contemporary story and with the 60s story as well.
Well, let's get back to my favorite character besides Allie, Fernando. So if Fernando were to create an educational plan, what would he do to help them better, get better? Because, you know, I listen to the news, and after teaching for 1,000 years, I guess back then, when I not too long ago, it was different. I was allowed creativity. I was allowed to do things differently. And if something didn't work with a student, I was able to come up with something that did. And my students actually all learned to read, and they were on grade level at the end. And I work with reading kids with learning disabilities that couldn't read in September.
Mm-hmm.
How it's different now. I mean, they're telling me that they just push them ahead, and that you're not allowed to hold anybody over, and the documentation. It's sad. So what would Fernando do? What kind of an educational plan would he come up with, Leon?
Well, the big idea behind Fernando's education plan, and he reveals it a tiny bit in the novel, is individuation. The idea that every kid needs to learn the way every kid learns. And,
that's right.
And there's a story in the novel where he talks about helping a kid understand math by understanding soccer. Because the kid's a huge soccer fan, and he wants to be a superstar soccer player when he grows up and that sort of thing, but he's having all kinds of struggles with math. And what Fernando understands is the kid is actually doing math. He just doesn't realize that he's doing math. But if he can show him the math of a soccer pitch, then maybe the kid can make that connection to other forms of math. And that level of individuation is something that, when it's used, is enormously effective in education. When you teach somebody the way they learn, you're probably familiar with Howard Gardner's multiple intelligences and that sort of thing. You know, different people have different forms of intelligence, and if a school system is trying to teach everybody the same way, it's guaranteed to fail, because only a segment of that. Of that student population actually learns that way. And if you can realize that, you know, this kid is an auditory learner, and this kid is a kinesthetic learner, that sort of thing, and they learn through different tools, and you can apply those tools, then everybody has their best possible chance of learning. And that was not a revolutionary thing. I wrote two books with Sir Ken Robinson, who's one of the great educators in the world, and it's something that Ken has been espousing for a long time, and other educators have been espousing as well. And the only way to really teach is to teach the way kids learn. So that's the key to Fernando's education plan. But you know, especially in the late 90s and early aughts, everything was about standardized testing, and so kids were all being taught to learn things, not only learn things the same way, but get back the information the same way. And he felt very strongly that was a huge mistake.
Well, I agree with that, because when I was working with the kids, they had learning disabilities. You try to teach each group of students, you know, how they learn. Now, some learn phonetically, some visually, some kinesthetically, some tactile. And you get to the point where you have to say, okay, I used to come in to school at 6:30 in the morning, literally, to teach a reading group of kids from grades 3 to 6. And they came because they wanted to. It was their time.
Right.
Because these were the children that came in from foreign countries that couldn't read anything at all. So they said, you know, and you had to teach them differently. And I said to them, do you mind if I take the books that I used when I went to school? And they didn't care what they did as long as they learned. So I agree, yeah. Individualization, and when I taught, it was like every student has to be taught to their interests and their abilities. And it's not that way anymore, unfortunately. That's sad. Really sad.
I do think that some schools are starting to move back in that direction.
I hope
so. It's got a long way to go.
Well, before I forget, and I don't want to forget, Stephen Manchester takes the spotlight on Monday with Bread, Bags, and Bullies.
Oh, is that true?
I know.
Great.
Yeah, that book was interesting. And then on the 8th, someone that I absolutely adore, she's phenomenal, Cindy McDonald in Bonjour Bon Voyage to Murder, Fiona's back, and you never know what she's going to do. On the 20th, this is interesting. It's a book called Shepherds of Destiny, and What Would You Do If Somebody's Brain Was Stuck in Your Brain, a Cyborg Brain. Interesting. On the 22nd, Walt Craig is there, and he's going to talk about The Chosen One. And if you want to know why someone becomes a jihadist and is forced into becoming a jihadist, you're going to learn why this little boy had no choice. And you either have to disagree or agree with what happens in the book. It was really scary and interesting. And on the 27th, the one and only Lee Matthew Goldberg and Vincent Jandry are coming. We're going to talk about writers, thriller writers, writing about thriller writers. And that's just January. I'm not even going to give away February. February is all gone. I mean, there's a ton of people in February. So, Alex and Fernando, they learn many lessons in this book. What would you say that each one learns about the other or about something in this book, and why?
Well, I think what Fernando learns from Alex is that that having a passion is a good thing. You know, Alex has is deeply committed to what he's doing and incredibly passionate about doing it. And Fernando has always sort of written that off and felt like passion is for other people. It's not for me. And what Fernando learns over the course of this story is that actually caring deeply about something has its benefits, and that's a significant thing. What Alex learns from Fernando is that being connected to your place in the world is actually important and is meaningful, and it's something that in some ways Alex has not connected with it. He hasn't really. He pays less attention to his birthright and more to just moving ahead. And he learns a great deal about one's place in the world from his time with Fernando.
How did you come up with the title Birthright? I'm reading the end of the product description. This is so cool, though. It says, playing out at once on the most global, the most intimate of stages, it is a story about the power one is born into and the power one earns, and at the very heart, the power of love. How did you come up with that, and how did you come up with the title Birthright, which I found exactly perfect for the story? Seriously.
Well, I'm glad you found it perfect. It took us about a half a year to come up with that title. We ran through about 40 others before we came to that. It has multiple meanings in the novel, and the whole sort of notion of birthright is a critical notion in the development of the story on all of those storylines that we're talking about. It really, I think it was Julian's idea. I think it was one of those where once we heard it, it sounded exactly right, but it didn't come to us for a long time.
Like, that was perfect. I mean, when I read the book and I'm going like, it can mean this, it can mean that, it can mean that. It's really good.
Mm-hmm.
It just sort of says it all.
I do love titles that do that. I actually try to have it in all of my books. I try to have titles that are double or triple entendres because I think it allows readers to sort of glean new meaning from what they're reading.
The cover says it all. That crown is gorgeous.
Oh,
I think everybody wants the emeralds and the rubies and the diamonds. Oh, my God. That's gorgeous. And, of course, the top one is my sapphire. That's my favorite. So the power of love is strong in this novel. So how does that relate to Alexandra and, finally, Fernando? That theme comes right through. Finally.
Really everything that all of these characters are doing, they're doing out of love. Sandra's great love is her love for Cayetano, even though they're sort of destined not to spend a lot of time together. But she also has a great deal of love for you know, for her life and for, you know, and for what she's, you know, what she's trying to do with her life. You know, Alex has an enormous amount of love for both his family and for his best friend, and almost every, and actually for his, you know, his best friend's father, and all of, and ultimately his decisions are driven more out of love than out of logic, and that's an important step forward for him because he's typically a very logical guy, and you know, and for Fernando, love really drives him to ultimately make the decisions that are most important for him to make, because he has, in a lot of ways, been downplaying the value of love. And you know, I mean, when he thinks of Alex as his best friend, he doesn't necessarily think of him as somebody he loves as much as he thinks of him as somebody he has a great time with, and he doesn't fully understand how deep that relationship is until very late in the game.
Well, there's sort of mutual respect there too, in a sense.
Oh, definitely too. That. Definitely that.
See, I got that, people. I told you. So one of the questions, I mean, I interviewed someone that wrote a book with James Patterson, and they wouldn't give this away. They wouldn't give it away. How do you write a book with someone else? Who writes which part of the plot, and how do you get it to go together? Because that can't be easy to get to write together. And are you in the same place? Are you writing, or are you just texting each other, or whatever? So how do you do that?
Julie and I live. You know, I'm in Connecticut. Julian's in New York, so we're not very far away from each other. But the way we work together is that we develop the story together, and we spend a lot of time doing that. Then I will write a draft of a chunk of the novel, and then Julie and I will sit down and go through it, and he'll have some thoughts about places where he wants to take it and that sort of thing, and then we'll work that through until the final. So in terms of the writing, all the words, you know, all the words on the page are mine. A tremendous number of the ideas in the novel are Julian's. And so that to me is sort of the ideal collaborative relationship. It becomes harder. This is the only fiction collaboration I've ever done. But, you know, I've collaborated on quite a number of nonfiction books. It is harder to do a book where both people are writing because it's very difficult to sort of have a unified voice when something like that happens. I suppose in a novel like this where you have, you know, three separate storylines, that you could conceivably have one person write one storyline and another person write another storyline. But I think that kind of thing is much, much more difficult. So I think the way to play it, the way it's always worked for me, is that when it works best is when there's one actual writer, and then the ideas come from multiple sources.
You know what I like, though? That you didn't write Alex is speaking on the chapter two and this one. You did it in different months, different time periods, different places.
Mm-hmm.
So it made it easier for me. I can't stand these books that say Mary's got this chapter and Tom's got this chapter, and then I wonder, wait a minute, you're not coherent. I mean, it's like whatever. It gets confusing, and I'm getting bored before I even start. So when it's a time period and it's different places, and I know who's speaking, I'm going like, this is so good. This is really good. And, of course, since I'll never get to Venice or the south of France, at least I got to visit them in your book. I mean, it's hard that I thought it was really good that you were able to explain it and describe it so I could actually see it, which made it even better.
Well, glad to hear that. Glad to hear that.
People. I got it. So were there any other, before I ask the final two questions, the hard ones of the day, are there any characters that I left out that you want to talk about? Because there's one or two that I purposely left out, if you know what I mean.
Okay. Okay. No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think we've gotten to the characters that I would expect to discuss, but now I'm curious about the ones that you feel you left out.
Angelica.
Okay. Well, I mean, I don't consider Angelica to be a major character in this story.
I know.
Angelica is Alex's wife, and she's sort of intentionally not a major character in this novel because the story is much more. The family story in this novel is much more about Alex's relationship with Allie, his daughter, than is his relationship with his wife. They have a very solid, loving relationship, but it wasn't terribly pertinent to this story.
Well, the ending of the story is really dramatic, and it'll shock the daylights out of everybody, I can tell you that. You're not going to expect this one, I'll tell you that. So, where do you see this going next, without giving it away? Where do you see this going as a sequel? Because people, I know there's going to be more. Seriously, I got that.
But I'm not even sure I could talk about it without giving too much away, so I'm going to pass on.
Okay. As long as you promise that you're not going to kill F. Allie. Can't do that. Sorry.
Don't worry about it. I can definitely promise you that.
Okay, so... where can we learn more about you and your work and about StoryPlant? Marcia Casper Cook just got off. She's a host of A Good Story is a Good Story. So I said to her, StoryPlant, she says, okay, I want to know more. She's probably going to look you up later. I know her.
Okay.
So tell us about StoryPlant and tell us about where we can learn more about you and with Julian. And what's next?
You can certainly learn more about me at louaronica.com. That's my personal website, and it's got information about both my fiction and my nonfiction. So there's that.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the StoryPlant is a publishing company that I started in 2008. My experience in the book business is I grew up in the book business. I was at Bantam Books for 14 years, ultimately serving as deputy publisher there. I moved on to become publisher of Berkeley Books and then publisher of Avon Books. And then I left to pursue a career in writing. But I was always fascinated with the publishing business and always sort of drawn to the publishing business. And I feel like I've got certain opinions about publishing that not everybody in the industry has. And so in 2008, I started the StoryPlant as a small independent fiction primarily, not fiction only, but fiction primarily publishing company. We've got, I think there's 165 books on our list at this point, a lot of really, really good fiction. A lot of really fine writers, including Steve Manchester, who you're talking to next week. And what we're really dedicated to is developing writers and helping writers bring their voices out in the richest expression of their writing. We publish books by writers who take writing seriously. And so, we don't publish, books where, somebody's writing six books a year or something like that.
I mean, I know what you're saying.
Every book we publish is something that the writer has spent, a fairly substantial amount of time developing.
And a story that has meaning. You don't do horror, do you?
No, I know we don't publish horror. Primarily, we publish. The three areas that we publish most actively in are women's fiction, thrillers, and literary fiction. We'll occasionally do a science fiction and fantasy novel, but occasionally do a nonfiction book. But for the most part, those are the areas that we publish in.
Oh, I'm so sorry because you don't do YA books. Actually, I can't wait to see. No, this is, I'm hoping that they take it, otherwise I'm going to get it published somewhere else. It's called Bertha, and it's a true story growing up in the South Bronx with my sister. And all the stories are really true, people, and they're hilarious. So I'm hoping to get that out in time for my sister's memorial in June, would be 10 years. So we're hoping for that. But Silent Voices is out on Amazon, and it's told from the point of view of the people behind the gravestone. And it's told from their point of view as to whether somebody did something to them to belong there, or they did something wrong and they deserve to be there. So Faces 6 will come out when I get around to writing it after a while. But I can't wait. If you need any help with your book reviews, let me know. I mean, everybody else sends them, so you can send them too. Everybody can send them. I don't mind. It's okay. I want to thank you so much. It's not so beautiful outside. It's raining, but that's okay. But
yes,
I want to thank
you
so much. And everybody have a great day. Thank you, Luz. Thank you so much. Cheryl's listening.
Lot,
everybody have a great day, and bye.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.